Right now it's time to welcome our technology commentator today. It is Steve McCabe, or will be very shortly Steve McCabe, on having some technology issues, actually. His subjects today, individual solar generation in New Zealand, also the patent war between Apple and Samsung, which is ongoing, and he's going to tell us why web surfing makes us work better. Steve, good morning to you.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And now, the solar generation in New Zealand, is this year having your own panels up on the roof or other alternative means of doing it?
Well, we're actually doing, in my very own home, in fact, is we are doing the panels on the roof, something that we just had done about 2 weeks ago. And, you know, today's probably the wrong day to be talking about it. I'm looking out my window right now and thinking, not getting a whole lot of use out of that.
There's been examples, hasn't there? I can think of one suburb in Wellington where people were very, this may be urban myth, very keenly putting up all these marvellous solar panels on their roof, only to find out there wasn't quite enough sun around.
Well, that's going to be just, unfortunately, rather short-sighted planning. We were very, very careful before we embarked on this. We spent about a year monitoring our electrical usage, and then we consulted with a local company who actually came out, went up on our roof with a camera and a measuring device, and worked out, based on a number of things, how much we could expect to generate in a year. So once we'd done those numbers, we decided it was going to look realistic, and they gave us actually what's looking like a fairly conservative estimate. So far, we're very happy with what we're seeing.
Let's go all the way back to the beginning.
Okay.
What made you think about doing it, and then how did you find out whether you could do it?
Well, let's see. Going back to the very, very beginning is we moved to a very, very old bungalow in Pukekohe about a year ago, and it was cold. And so we started heating the place, and we were realizing that we were paying an awful lot in electricity. Now, we've done all the sensible things like insulating, but we still realized that electricity was costing us a fortune. So we thought, well, how can we start to mitigate that a little bit? And we started looking into various opportunities, and we sort of stumbled across solar generation as one possibility. And there's a company locally who do the whole deal, will install everything for us. So we talked to them, and we decided that the numbers made sense. We talked to our bank, who were willing to roll this into the mortgage. And so based on what we've seen so far, if our numbers keep on the same way they're going, and like I said, we've got about a year's worth of data from our own usage figures to compare with, we're looking that basically we're going to break even month by month over the course of the year between what the additional mortgage costs will be and what we're saving by not paying electricity bills.
How much do you think you'll be able to get to total generation?
Well, realistically, we're looking at an average of somewhere in the order of 20 kilowatt hours, 20 units a day. That's an average spread out over the entire year.
And that would account for how much of your total consumption?
Almost exactly everything.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. Now, one of the nice things about the system we've got going is that on a day like today, obviously, we're not generating a whole lot of anything. And so we're sucking in electricity from the national grid, and we pay for it at the regulars somewhere in the low 20s, like 22 cents, I think it is, per unit. Come the middle of the summer, when we're not using heating and the sun's going to be shining for many hours in a day, we're going to be generating way more than we can use. And so what we'll actually end up doing then is selling that back to the grid. And we found a power company who are actually willing to give us the same price when we sell it as the price that they're charging when we buy it from them.
This is very interesting, because the idea that lots of New Zealanders might invest in this technology and it might seriously become an alternative to the national grid depends on what you can do with the excess, doesn't it?
Well, exactly, because during the day, you know, like I say, there's going to be a lot of time when you've got excess that just has to go somewhere. And we've not gone down the battery route because we want to stay connected to the grid. So the idea is we're going to sell back. Now, I know this is something I'm not supposed to say in New Zealand, but the Australians are doing it better. One of the things that you'll see over in Australia, in Victoria, for example, is a similar retail price in the low 20s of cents for a unit bought retail from the grid. But what they call the feed-in tariff, the price that the companies pay back to the customers, is around 60-ish cents. So there's a huge incentive to get people to do this micro-generation. In Canada, for example, in Ontario, they're paying around 60 cents for the feed-in tariff. The retail rate's closer to 4 cents. So there's a huge incentive to take the load off the national grid and to distribute the generation load.
Yeah, but who's got the incentive?
Individual homeowners.
Right. And is the same incentive there for the generators to provide these systems?
Well, the incentive that the generators are going to get is it reduces their infrastructure costs. It suddenly means that they don't need to build new power stations. They don't need to be investing in new generation facilities because that burden is being taken away from them.
What about the retailers in the middle? What are the incentives for them in encouraging this?
Now, that's a very good question, and that's going to be a bit of politics, which I'm going to kind of have to defer to and just say, well, this is a technology slot. I'm being a bit of a coward on that one, I realise. All I know is from the tech point of view, clearly there is an incentive, which is why it's being done. Germany's doing it. Many United American states are doing it. There's clearly a model that works in a lot of places. And there would be, in my opinion, a much larger uptake in New Zealand if a similar model were observed here.
What is the technology of feeding back into the grid? How does it practically work?
Invisibly, to all intents and purposes, basically what happens is, in my fuse box in my house, I've got two inputs. Most people are going to have one. That just comes from the grid. I've got two. That then goes to a meter on my wall outside that was replaced. It used to be the old spinning disc meter. I've now got an electronic meter on my wall outside the house, which has two displays on it. One shows how much electricity I've bought from the grid during the day, and then the second number is how much I've sold back. And so very simply, when I get my bill at the end of the month, I'm going to be paying basically for the price of one number subtracted from the other.
So your plea is, would more companies please make it possible for more of us to do this?
Well, first of all, what we'd love to see is at the very least, one-for-one pricing. And what I'd love to see, not just the companies, I'd love to see this go all the way down to Wellington, to the Beehive. Let's see some political will to get feed-in tariffs more in line with what we're seeing in other places around the world.
The patent wars going on between Apple and Samsung. I think we've touched on this previously in the past. It's getting very nasty.
It's actually kind of getting comical, to be perfectly honest. It's reaching some incredible depth. I mean, we've got two major players here. We've got the number one Apple and the number two Samsung smartphone makers in the world. And it really is, I mean, in terms of patent wars, it's a world war. They're currently suing each other around the world. I could rattle off a list of a dozen countries here, from the Netherlands to Japan to Australia to Italy to you name it. They're suing each other over patent violations, primarily Apple suing Samsung for ripping off the interface features of the iPhone.
How does this affect the consumer? Because if the company you've bought the phone from is being sued, what could a negative outcome mean for you as a consumer?
Well, what it's going to mean for a consumer who's already bought is nothing. Nobody's going to come and take your phone away from you because it's a patent violation. What it can mean is that, for example, in Australia, Samsung at the moment have voluntarily agreed not to sell their tablets. I believe it's called the Galaxy Tab. It's the device that they're not selling. And what this means, unfortunately, is less choice for the customer. Basically, now, if you want to buy a tablet, you're buying an iPad.
It's not going to be a case, though, where, okay, you haven't breached patent with what you've purchased, but the company might somehow withdraw services that you need?
Well, that's one possibility, yes. One thing that Samsung is starting to do now is the system that has been enjoined against is the tablet that's based on Google's Android platform, and that's the one that they've had to pull off the shelves. People have already started buying that, and that's all well established, but they're now developing their own operating system. They're calling, I believe it's pronounced Bada, it's the Korean word for ocean, but that's their own proprietary operating system, and that's where all their resources are going to start going in future. So what that means practically for existing customers is there is a real danger that existing Android-based tablets might not be supported by Samsung in the future. You've got your piece of kit, but you're on your own now.
What are the patents over? Are they over preposterous things?
They're over trivial things, to be perfectly honest. One of the main things that Apple's suing over is a patent that they've got over the way in which your finger moves photographs around on a touch screen when you're viewing digital photos in a digital photo application. That's one example. Another one, that one got upheld, by the way, one that got overturned was anyone who's used an iPhone might be familiar with the slide to unlock feature. When you first turn the machine on, you have to slide your finger across the screen to unlock it. And basically a judge said, come on, that's so screamingly obvious that you don't really deserve a patent on it.
It's like an on button.
Pretty much, yes. And so,
has anyone ever tried to patent the on switch? That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. I mean, that's a screamingly obvious idea. And, you know, routinely people do try and patent the wheel, for example. And that one goes on all the time. But one of the reasons why they can't is the concept of prior art. Obviously, I can't patent something that you have already developed. Whether you've patented it or not is irrelevant. The fact is, it's prior art. It exists. And I can't take credit for your genius. And that's well established in patent law. Now, one of the things that Samsung have tried to say with Apple's iPad devices is that there was prior art that should deny or invalidate their patent. And what they're invoking is, in fact, Stanley Kubrick's film 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Brilliant.
Anna, you couldn't make this stuff up, could you? It's fantastic.
And William Gibson. There's all sorts of writers who say that, you know, what I wrote was clearly the founding of this, and sometimes actually they're quite right.
Oh, yeah, but the difference is, I suppose, they didn't actually make it. I mean, you know, if you look at, say, I'm really burnishing my geek credentials here, but say Star Trek, starting with the Next Generation series, you'll see them, the characters in those shows, they're all flashing around these flat tablets. They've got the black screens with the lit up text on top of them. And I mean, obviously, those are predecessors in many ways to the iPad. You look and you think, oh, wow, that's the iPad on TV 15 years ago. But the reality is that was just a prop. It didn't do anything. And you can't really say that Apple ripped off the idea from the iPad from seeing that, but that's what Samsung are trying to claim.
What are the judges saying to all this?
Well, the judges, like I say...
Thanks for paying our salaries, possibly.
Well the lawyers, obviously, are, you know, are lawyering fantastically. Now, in Australia, like I say, the Samsung lawyers have said they're going to voluntarily pull the Galaxy Tab off the shelves until the end of September, and that's so that they can do it themselves because they haven't been told to, which gives them the opportunity to change their minds. But, for example, in Germany, a judge has said that there's going to be no Samsung tablets sold in Germany until at least September the 9th. They're going to reconsider after that. In the Netherlands, a Dutch judge has banned 3 Samsung smartphones. He said, no, that's clearly a patent violation. You're going to need to redesign that thing before it goes back on the shelves again.
Oh, lordy. Web surfing makes you work better.
Really? Yes, absolutely. Here's our excuse for wasting our time at work. It's fantastic.
I won't tell you what screen I'm on right now.
No. We'll just guess. the screen I usually look at these days is the web server from my solar power inverter telling me on a day like today how little power I'm generating.
That is train spotting of the very scariest kind.
Oh, I'm a proud geek, absolutely.
Why is web surfing good for us?
Why is it good for us? Well, the argument goes that if you're at work and you're allowed to take a break, web surfing is a passive experience. I mean, you can tell oftentimes from the glazed looks on people's faces when they're staring at web pages that it's a one-way experience. You're not really producing any new intellectual energy, let's say. The idea is that if you're going to give your workers a break, let them surf the web, let them look at Facebook, wherever it might be. God forbid Farmville. But you're going to let them actually take their brains off the hook for a while. I mean, there is a degree, as I'm speaking this myself, I can actually hear myself thinking, well, duh. But the reality is that when you're surfing the web, you're doing something non-exertive with your brain. Whereas if you are even just reading through work emails, you're processing stuff. You're looking at it in a critical way. You're actually engaging your brain.
You're involved.
You are. Even if you're just saying, oh, save that for later. Now, the thing is, you and I can both figure this one out quite straightforwardly. We go, well, yeah, that's right. The fact is, we are not the Singaporean scientists who actually did a survey on this and actually discovered that it's true and published a paper about it.
What were the results that back their claims?
What they actually did, their methodology, and it's a little bit trivial to be fair, was they had workers who didn't get a break. They had another group who got a break but weren't allowed to use the net. And they got another group who were allowed to surf to their heart's content. And after that, they gave them a passage of text and told them to circle all the letter E in it.
Right.
And the ones who did a bit of surfing apparently were sufficiently mentally recharged that they could spot the letter E more efficiently.
So if you need more E's in your life, WebSurf. This is like playing Patience, isn't it? This is just a more interesting version of playing online Patience cards, you know?
Well, playing Patience does in fact involve a degree of mental acuity, I suppose. You have to be looking to for places to play cards.
You're not terribly involved emotionally, though, are you? I mean, Crossword's another example of that.
Oh, yeah. But what they're saying is, I think the point they're making is that with web surfing, by and large, it's like the web equivalent of watching TV.
It's true.
You sit there and let it wash over you.
Or you laugh because whatever you've seen is ridiculous.
Absolutely. It's a bit of fun.
Mm.
Yeah. But what is more telling is the fact that people have figured out what makes you very unproductive at work as well. And this is one that I find absolutely fascinating, is a Swiss political party are getting into the tech game now.
Yeah.
I hear you sighing already, you know.
There are many words in that sentence that have just made me switch off, but come back on.
Well, believe it or not, it actually involves Swiss people with what looks like a sense of humour. Which a shocker right there, I realise.
Yes.
There is a Swiss political party, and I realise that's probably where I lost you. Swiss political party, who are actually running on one prime policy, and that's the banning of PowerPoint presentations.
Outstanding.
I know, they get my vote, I tell you.
Does anyone still do them?
Are you kidding? Their research is saying, and I've got the numbers in front of me right here, they're claiming that on average, 11% of all Swiss people have to attend PowerPoint presentations up to twice a week. They are ubiquitous in the extreme.
Lordy.
I know.
That's where you can be sitting there with your iPhone that someone else has got a patent out on, playing Patience or surfing.
Absolutely.
And completely ignoring the PowerPoint.
Well, I think that's probably what most people do. And so the argument goes that because that's going on, they're saying that in Switzerland there's around $3 billion worth of productivity being wasted every year by people simply staring at screens and having someone stand in front of the screen and read to them the text that's displayed on the screen.
Which is boring anyway.
Absolutely.
So seriously, I don't know what the political system is in Switzerland. They could end up with, you know, like the balance of power, potentially, couldn't they?
Well, conceivably. Unfortunately, at the moment, the way the system works there, apparently, is if you want to get on the ballot, you have to get a petition with 10,000 signatures on it. And they've got 300 so far. I mean, what they really need to do is put together a PowerPoint presentation, explain their policies, and get people to pay attention to it.
The PowerPoint's Microsoft's baby, isn't it? It inflicted it on the world.
Absolutely. But to be fair, though, to be fair to the anti-PowerPoint party, and yes, that is their name in English, they have a website and everything, which you can surf when you're taking a break from work, they do actually specify other presentation software is available, and yes, we're opposed to all of them.
We are opposed to all versions of PowerPoint thereof. I suppose it was worse when people just stood up and read speeches and you couldn't even stare at their utterly meaningless kind of bullet points.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think what they want to go back to is flip charts. It's like
they were fun at school.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Because, back then, I mean, one of the big advantages, and, you know, this coming from a tech correspondent who badges himself as being a professional geek, the one thing about paper is it's compatible with damn near everything.
Yeah.
I've shown up to do many presentations and spent 15 minutes looking for the right kind of connector.
What's really funny is, and this is where the sort of flip page thing has the advantage over the PowerPoint, is someone who's given like a felt pen, is the old-fashioned word. What are they called these days? A marker.
Yes, that'll do.
And they just start sketching whatever's supposedly coming out of their head, and there's just all these insane arrows and circles and utterly meaningless constructions going up on the piece of paper that no one can make any sense of, including the person responsible for it. But
yeah.
It was more interesting, wasn't it, than seeing a perfectly formed PowerPoint?
Well, one of the big advantages for that was, of course, it had the potential to be organic. When I walk in with a PowerPoint presentation, and yes, I am guilty, it's something that's been pre-prepared. I'm not going to be able to edit that as I stand in front of my audience. Or at least with a flip chart, if I've got a marker pen, at least I can do that.
You can end up scribbling the whole lot out, which is what should have happened in the first place.
Yes, possibly more efficient, certainly more engaging. And like I say, there's less tendency to do what I've seen several people do, which is put entire paragraphs of fantastically dense text on a screen. You can barely read it, so you're actually quite grateful they read it to you. But then you can read it yourself, because it's giving you a handout with it in the notes anyway.
They shouldn't have banned PowerPoint. They should have a banned meeting party. That would solve everything.
Oh, I'd vote for them.
Good talking to you. Thanks.
You too. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. That is our new technology slot, Steve McCabe, our commentator today.